Our special guest, Leslie Mitchell Clark, her book, Intersections. We're going to be back and talk more about alien abductions and that phenomena, and also take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Leslie Mitchell Clark. Our hour will take calls. Have you found that any of your patients, Leslie, wished these experiences never happened to them?
I think when they initially come to me, that is the overwhelming feeling that they experience. They feel many of them have incredible sleep disorders, because you can imagine if things are going on at night, you're afraid to sleep, you don't sleep, and it's gone on for years and years.
Yeah.
So I do think that is a very common reaction before we put that person back in charge of their life. And, you know, we tend to find, George, and this is something that's kind of a big subject, but I think that before we come into physical life, when we're in the interlife, you know, what we would call heaven or the zone, the high vibrational zone where we exist before we physicalize here on Earth or any other planet, I think that we make agreements. And I think this is a very important time right now, because disclosure is imminent. Everything in the world is going to change, and I believe remarkably for the better. I can't help but be optimistic when I hear about the kind of help that many of our ET cousins are willing to offer if we will just clean up our own backyard.
Absolutely, indeed. Since you've been doing this, and you've been doing it now for quite a while,
yeah.
Where does it take us? What's going to happen next?
Well, as I said, I believe the disclosure movement is a grassroots movement where people who are communicating with ETs are receiving information. I think the vibration of the Earth is elevating. My hope would be that we are able at some point to join what I am told is not unlike Gene Roddenberry's United Federation of Planets, that there is, in fact, an organization of like-minded beings. I think some of them are interdimensional, ultra-terrestrial, if you will, but there are a group of souls, beings in our soul group, beings that we can even, you know, meet in other lifetimes or have met. So I think that agreements go into place. And I think that experiencers come in with the idea that when they reach a certain point of maturity, they are going to become a representative, in a sense, for the ETs and, you know, provide information, disclose information that not everybody can receive, because not everybody is an open channel.
Are there witnesses to any of these experiences, people who see these things happening to the other people?
It's very hard to catch that, George, and because especially in some of the experiences people have that are actually abductions, and by abduction, I hate to use that term, but what I mean by that is when someone is taken, possibly against their will, levitated, you know, through the walls or up through the, you know, roof and taken on a craft, something like that. You know, I think that some of these negative experiences are actually positive ones when they are viewed with the overview of complete recall and with perhaps the idea that we are participants and partners in disclosure. We are not victims. So that's essentially what I see happening. I see a vibrational shift occurring. And George, you're part of this, because it's all about waking people up and consciousness. And it's no accident that your program reaches the vast amount of people that it does.
True.
And, you know, there are other people doing their, you know, their part too, to get out there and interview and talk. So by opening people's minds, we are changing vibration.
When you start a past life regression or a hypnotic regression to find out if they've been abducted, how do you begin?
Well, it begins with trust, I would say. It begins with trust. The individual who's coming to me, I have to make them feel comfortable and safe, because they are going to be in an altered state. And that, and to them, to experiencers, that's a very vulnerable feeling, because that's very similar to what happens to them during these ET encounters. They are in an altered state. Their vibration is accelerated in some way. So the first thing is trust. And then I put the individual into a very deep state of relaxation. And when the body is physically relaxed enough, and this is essentially how hypnosis works in general, when the body is physically relaxed enough, then we are able to sort of push that curtain aside that separates the conscious mind, which is a little part of us, from the subconscious mind, which is the biggest part of us, which does contain memories of anything, everything that we have ever seen, felt, heard, smelled. So I have complete, if I can get somebody relaxed enough, I can then access the subconscious mind. I can move them around in a timeline, and I can move them back. Also, if that's the indication, if they're here for past life regression, I can move them back, you know, beyond birth.
All right, let's take some calls here for you. Let's start with going to Diane in Los Angeles, first-time caller. Hello, Diane.
Well, hi there. It's so good to talk to you again. And Leslie, I'm really interested in your topic. I myself have had several psychic experiences starting in 1970. Mm-hmm. And when it kept going on, predicting that there was a Cocker Spaniel that, you know, I wanted to find a blonde Cocker Spaniel, which were not popular at the time. Mm-hmm. I had this dream that Actors for Animals in the Valley had one there. And I thought I was crazy, but it seemed so real that I was literally on the ceiling looking down at the man, trying to get him to find my card that I left there with my phone number, and he wouldn't do it. So I drove out there the next day, and sure enough, this blonde Cocker Spaniel lifted it up, kissed me, and that
Aww.
Was the end. It was just, so that I thought was, you know, first time was a little unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Then about 10 years later, two people on my block got pregnant, and I knew for sure one of them was going to have a boy, and the other party I went to that, you know, the showers, mm-hmm. and I came home, and I wasn't even aware of it, and somebody said, well, what are you so upset about? Did you have a bad time? And I said, no. I said, I had a great time, but I'm so sad because she really wants to have a boy, and she's having a girl. Mm. And it was like, I didn't even know what I was saying. It was like, it just came out like, and that's exactly what happened with both of them. So
wow.
This went on and on to the point where I started researching, is there anybody out there that knows about premonitions? Went to Dr. Robert Moody's lectures. I came across Dr. Thelma Moss from UCLA Psychiatric mm-hmm. Institute. She had a class that she had invited me to based on my information that I gave her, and everybody in that class was psychic in one way or the other.
Yeah.
And so they brought in the police department with specimens in an envelope for us to try to help them determine, you know, anything about the scene or the crime or whatever was in the envelope. So, I mean, she did marvelous things in regressing one of the people in the class, finding out that she had seen the call numbers on the plane mm-hmm. that crashed in, I think it was San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
In the 80s, I believe it was,
yes.
Or maybe it was LAX. I honestly don't remember, but she was absolutely amazing. So when she had another class where it was filled with probably about 75 people and she wanted a volunteer for regressing, I just couldn't put my hand up fast enough or hard enough for her to pick me. And she did. And I often wondered why I was so afraid of fire. I mean, unusually for every little reason. Anyway, she regressed me with all these people watching, and it was like I was under hypnosis. I couldn't have cared less that, you know, there were any people even there. And she brought me back to London, which I thought was interesting because I had always had a passion for going there and studying. And I think I'd been there at that point about 15 different times. Had seen a lot of, you know, sites and touristy places. But until this, I didn't know that something existed. And basically what happened was she brought me back and she showed me that it was my bakery on Pudding Lane that caused the Great Fire of London. And then when I started crying, and I literally was sweating on stage because I was standing next to the fire, she then quickly, when I started crying, she quickly brought me forward into time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was older and living in the West End. Anyways, afterwards, she asked for comments from the people sitting in the audience. And there was a fellow visiting from London that raised his hand and said to her, she had asked me to describe, what do I see? I saw my clothes. I described it. I told her I saw a monument and that on the very top it was gold, but I didn't know anything about what I was saying. That's all. I was just repeating what I was seeing. So this fellow raises his hand and he says, I know exactly what she's talking about. It's literally called the monument. And if you lay it down in an easterly direction, about 200 feet from where the fire started, it's a commemorative to that fire. Mm. So the next time, of course, that I went to England, I went to see it, and I was baffled that how could nobody have ever told me about it. And then come to find out, very few people know about the monument, nor do they care, I think.
Yeah.
So, all right, the last part of the thing that was so amazing is about a year later, I was reading the Sunday paper, and there was a professor that had just passed away from Claremont College that left all these books that were written of English history going back to 1667, year after the fire. And it was open to the public. And I thought that was absolutely amazing that they would let anybody put their hands on something that old.
Yeah.
So I went running out there, and I was the only one in this little library. And the lady told me I could pick any book out and sit down and read it. And I did. And I don't know who the author was. I should have written it down. But he basically wrote, you know, in old English, but it was easy enough to understand, that he believed that the fire started because God was very unhappy with all the people. And I don't know if I can even say this word on the air.
No.
Anyways, for being wild, okay?
That you can say. So what do you think of all of that, Leslie? Jeez.
Well, I absolutely believe in the existence of past lives, of course, and I'm not sure that that time is really linear in the way that we think of it. But yes, absolutely, it is possible to experience get physical sensation and details of some past life regressions that I have done have had enough information in them where the lifetime could actually be validated. And, you know, that's a little bit unusual because we get back much farther in time than a couple of hundred years, and it's a little more difficult. But the fact that you had, you know, confirmation, you really did have a lot of confirmation about your memories because you had no knowledge of that location or even that that's where the fire had started. So I think that is a real excellent validation of that lifetime and other lifetimes. And I'd just like to pop in one little thing and say that it's not all that unusual for people to recall lifetimes where they have incarnated on another planet and look slightly physically.
What about future incarnations? Do they people pick that up in hypnotherapy?
They can. We can do future progressions.
You can.
Yes, I believe so because, you know, I don't think that time is linear. I think it's all kind of happening simultaneously in a way, and simply by tuning the dial, tweaking the vibrational dial, we are free to travel on the path of the heart into our many past lives.
Let's go to Bill in Los Angeles. Hey Bill, welcome to the show.
Hi, George. Probably know this is coming as a former newspaper journalist. I'm having a little bit of trouble distinguishing how Leslie differentiates between the scientific method and just pure subjectivism. Specifically, when she mentions people like Corey Good, who's got a lot of, you know, even people like George Knapp consider tall tales about visiting other planets, and the stories about, Corso claiming that Truman had a deal with with ETs. And I'm open-minded as far as visitations from other planets. But what do you use, Leslie, to differentiate between hokum and just pure subjectivism and stuff that can be scientifically evaluated?
Well, I would love the opportunity to regress someone and have them completely wired up, you know, scientifically. It's just that it doesn't always tell us a whole lot. We can know people are in the alpha state, and actually there is scientific evidence that the people that have been studied when they're having regression, that the parts of the brain that are firing are memory centers and not necessarily creative centers of the brain. So it is possible to have scientific validation, I believe, of the regression process. However, it's not something, you know, commonly used in with a practicing hypnotherapist. And I do sort of, you know, I skirt the line between objecticism and subjective things that I hear. But what I must try to convey is the emotional validity of the experiences that people are recounting.
And I bet that's pretty heavy too.
It is. And the fact is that I don't know if there is a scientific way to firmly prove one way or the other that someone is fabricating or not fabricating. Is it possible to fool me? I think it's possible. I think it's very unlikely. Simply because, for many of the reasons I've mentioned before, people are unlikely to, if they're mentally healthy, they're unlikely to seek me out unless there are real issues and ongoing issues. So I guess I do the absolute best that I can to remain objective. And remember, all I'm doing is asking benign questions. I have to be scrupulous that I am not leading the client or the patient anywhere, that all that I'm doing is helping to record what is coming out more or less naturally. So that's kind of how the system works as far as I'm concerned. And indeed, yes, there are a lot of, I know that there are many people have come under criticism, Corey Good, one of them. I will mention, though, as far as someone who I feel is incredibly valid, especially as far as the secret space program is concerned, is Captain Randy Kramer. I know him personally. I know he has passed 3 lie detector tests, and there is no doubt that he believes what he is saying, and also the fact that his story has never changed, not in the many years he's been talking about his experiences. That's also another big indicator of truthfulness, I guess. But, you know, I think when you see, if you go back, there's a lot of material now, a lot of recordings, a lot of material of, in fact, I think most of the sessions of Barney Hill that were conducted by Dr. Simon are available, and you can get them on YouTube. And once you hear someone in the depths of fear or recounting an experience like this, someone who is mentally healthy, someone who does not have a dissociative disorder, that is the thing that it probably would take.
It's pretty dramatic stuff. Leslie, we're going to take a quick break and come back with final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back with final calls with Leslie Mitchell Clark as we talk about aliens and extraterrestrial contact on our next Coast to Coast program. For the first couple hours, Nick Pope joins us as he talks about the incredible discoveries he's made in ufology, and then Animals for Healing later on in the program. So make sure you're part of the show. And welcome back. Our final segment, George Norrie with you, along with Leslie Mitchell Clark. Leslie, what is what you call staging or screen memory? What is that?
Well, this is something that is used all the time by, ETs of various types for various purposes. But we see it an awful lot in the, the early abductions of individuals that take place earlier in their life. I'll tell you a couple of incidents that that happened with Wes Roberts, who is the subject in my book. So Wes had been taken since, you know, he was a very, very small person. And when he got to be about, I guess he was probably about 12, this was one of the screen memories that he recalled. He was, you know, he was, I think, levitated out of his room, taken out of his room, and he was fighting that, fighting to be conscious, fighting to not go, but he went with some difficulty, and he found himself sitting in a very strange environment that was supposed to be like a birthday party for someone that he didn't know. So he said there were a bunch of children his own age, you know, sitting on chairs in a circle, and some of them were completely unconscious. In other words, just turned off, just out. Some of them were semi-conscious, and a few of them were as conscious as he was. And he said also that he recognized many of these children from other experiences where he'd been taken and been put through some kind of an exercise. So at some point, you know, the so-called there's a individual who comes out dressed as a clown, which was terrifying to the kids. I think that sometimes in these stagings, they're imperfect, and the ETs don't always know what is going to frighten us. Sometimes they're trying to create environments that are comforting. And this was supposed to be, I believe, a comforting environment that could then lead to a kind of a pediatric examination. And so eventually this being came out and greeted the children, who was wearing like a doctor's coat, like a medical coat, but a clown mask.
Oh, I hate clowns.
Terrifying. That's onophobia, George. That's one of the big fears. I've worked with many people to get over it. It's a big one. So at this point, when the doctor, or what my client referred to as one of the brown doctors, when he came out with the mask on, then he started making a scene. And within seconds, bam, the whole illusion, the whole construct was gone, and he landed in his bed with kind of a thump.
I bet. Let's go to the calls. Mike in Las Vegas. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi. I just have a quick question. Sure. I recently discovered that I'm an empath. I'm 53. A couple years ago, I had a dream, and in my dream, God told me to write a journal. The funny thing is, when I told my wife about it the next morning, we were walking in downtown Denver, and I tripped and fell over a blank journal laying in the sidewalk.
No.
So, you know, what you do in that situation, you start writing.
Yes.
But it led me to some places, you know, that I never expected. It's helped me to set down some burdens that I've carried all my life. Mm-hmm. And I've also had some visions. I saved my wife's life with one. And right now, it's like I'm in a whirlwind, and I just wanted to know if maybe you had some advice. I never had no psychic things before this.
Well, it sounds like you are very naturally tuned in and have natural abilities, and also, you know, the fact that...
That's a gift.
Yeah, it is a gift. I would say, you know, there are a lot of very interesting online communities that you could discover with like-minded people. And I think just a little bit of research, and George himself may have some recommendations. Where are you located?
I'm in Las Vegas right now.
Oh, you're in Vegas. That's right. You said that. Well, I know that there is an active MUFON group out there. There are many active groups that deal with both just psychic phenomena and metaphysical phenomena, and also ufology. So I would suggest, first of all, reading everything you can get your hands on that kind of applies or is loosely related to someone who is waking up and beginning to get in touch with their own abilities. And so I would do as much reading as you can, and I would also perhaps search online in your area and see if you can find a group that is like-minded that you can then, you know, you can then exchange ideas and experiences with other people and figure out how they're doing it. I mean, you just have to do it your way. You know, everybody is an individual. How people wake up, how they use their psychic gifts, there's not really a rule book. And so, you know, just have faith in yourself. Have faith in yourself that you have an ability, you can do, you can, you're insightful, and you will know the right things to do.
How many people are reaching out with these abilities and they don't understand them, Leslie?
Oh, many, George. Many. You know, as I said, I think the whole planet is waking up. And part of that is people that maybe didn't acknowledge their earlier experiences. I think it's more that. I think that the people who are now calling and telling me that things are happening, I think it's an awareness of things that have always gone on.
Let's go to North Dakota. Jeremy's with us. Hello, Jeremy. Good morning.
Good morning, George. And Leslie, I kind of have an odd question.
Okay.
I was in a terrible car accident over 17 years ago, and I have traumatic brain injury.
Yes.
Would I be able to be hypnotized?
I actually do quite a bit of medical hypnosis, and I have worked with a number of clients who are suffering from recovering, rather. I'm not going to use the word suffering, in a process of recovery of traumatic brain injury. So, yes, it is perfectly possible for you to receive therapeutic hypnosis. And I can tell you that, you know, when we're working in those areas as hypnotherapists, we can really direct a lot of healing. We can really stimulate your own body to do what it needs to do to, you know, to continue with your healing process.
Absolutely. Yeah. How long do you take to hypnotize somebody? A couple minutes, hours?
Well, I can do it really, if I have to, I can put someone under very quickly within a few moments. The average time that if I'm doing, you know, straight ahead therapeutic hypnosis for something like insomnia or fear of clowns or getting rid of an addiction or whatever, I usually spend about 15 minutes getting them into a relaxed state. But part of that, George, is everybody is stressed. And so I take the opportunity when anybody gets in my chair to de-stress them and bring them to a point of relaxation because most people are overwhelmed. But I take about 15 minutes. Now, if I'm doing a regression process, that is a deeper type of trance, and we, you know, we can work in the alpha, but we like to get people into the theta state. And so I will generally take more like a half an hour to get them in.
And how long does it take to get them out?
I bring people out gradually, but when it's a trance, for instance, for one thing, just let me say that all hypnosis is really self-hypnosis. I'm a guide. It's all self-hypnosis, and if the person is on board, it will work. If the person is not on board, or they're fearful or mistrusting, or then it most likely won't work. But George, I forgot the actual question you just asked me.
Well, we were talking about putting people under.
Oh yes. Well, they come out when I'm putting people under for, you know, say they're biting their nails. You know, one of the more mainstream processes. It's extremely easy to bring people out. I just count them up to 10, and I snap my fingers or clap my hands, and they're immediately conscious. But a person, if they become disturbed or upset during the hypnosis for any reason, and I'm talking about a mainstream practice or a deep regression or metaphysical process, they can pull themselves out of trance at will. It's a little bit like it's a little bit like waking yourself up, or if it's not as deep an induction, it's almost just like coming out of a daydream. But there's no power that allows me to put someone into hypnosis and they won't be able to get out.
Could you theoretically hypnotize somebody and over the phone?
I have.
Wow.
Yes.
So
yes.
You could probably do it over the radio and hypnotize all of us.
Maybe. Be careful.
Don't do it if people are driving.
No, that's true. That's true. It might work well in one time zone, but not necessarily a great thing in another time zone. And I do tell people when I do regression processes, I don't let people drive or leave. I let them sit down, have a cup of tea or water, and chill for about a half an hour before I let them go.
East of the Rockies, Kim's with us in the state of Michigan. Hi, Kim. Go ahead.
Oh, hey, George. I have been meaning to ask you this question for a while, and also a question for Leslie is, have you seen the movie called The Fourth Kind? That was a pseudo-documentary, mm-hmm. where they had acting and actual regressive footage, hypnotherapy sessions by a doctor named Abigail Tyler.
Yes, I've seen that.
In Alaska.
Yeah.
Isn't that movie incredible? And people were talking like in Sumerian, I guess.
Kind of scary.
Yes, well, you know, that's a piece of fiction. You know, it was very cleverly done.
I mean, but something happened in Nome, Alaska a long time ago. Something happened.
Yeah, something happened. But as far as the kinds of things that are depicted, the negative aspects and the, you know, that kind of thing does not occur. Now, I have regressed people, and they have spoken in other languages. That's something that has occurred.
Yeah, interesting movie. What did you think about that movie, Kim?
Oh, I thought it was fascinating, especially because it had real-life footage of her sessions. And, I mean, it was incredible how people, you know, just became, I don't know, seemed like entities were, ETs were speaking through them.
Yes.
It was really crazy.
You know, this does happen. In fact, you know, one thing I would say that at the point that I am now working with people in the way that I am working with long-term experiencers, it is a lot more like they are channeling benevolent beings that they have an agreement with. So there is a lot of what I would call channeled material that is coming through, not unlike Daryl Anka, who of course has been channeling Bashar for
right.
I don't know how long, many years,
years, years. Point,
40 years probably, but what begins to happen when an experiencer moves past fear and moves past any negativity that may have occurred, they are then moving into the zone of being able to allow evolved beings to communicate through them. And this does happen in my sessions now.
Let's get a quick call in from Blair in Sedona, Arizona. Hey, Blair, go for it.
You, Leslie, do you believe that disclosure will be telepathic for a while longer? What do you think about that idea?
Well, I think a while longer, but also, you know, we are having more and more obvious phenomena. It's not that there isn't going to be phenomena. I think that just look at the amount of programming that is on just even mainstream television that deals with this subject matter. We are like a people obsessed, a people thirsty for knowledge. And thirsty to find other people who are open to the same kinds of things that we are. So, yes, I do think it will be mainly a telepathic type of event for a while longer, but I think that even though they're saying no, that I think there may be some very obvious things that cannot be denied. I mean, a lot of these things can't be denied. I mean, even the Tic Tac can't be denied.
That's right.
So we're moving into an area where there will be more and more hard evidence.
Would you give out your website, Leslie?
Yes, I can be reached. My website is lightworkhypnosis.com, and I am always happy to receive a text or a call. And I always give out my mobile, which is fine with me, and that's 416-454-8041. If you just want to talk about the possibility that you may have had an experience, I'm always ready to listen.
Super. Thanks, Leslie. Keep in touch. You did a great job. Leslie Mitchell Clark, the name of the book, Intersections. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasore, Ryan Stacy, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.